This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, some very personal, very political poems.
Language is most useful when it teaches us the language of how to relate to each other.
This is another episode in an ongoing experiment with a new format for this podcast. We've been bringing in younger poets, two at a time, to talk about what they want to talk about and to read poems that speak to them right now.
I grow older if I'm lucky, and I'm lucky.
Not long ago, we got Brian Russell and Dinez Smith together for a chat. Brian Russell is the author of The Year of What Now? Dinez Smith is the author of Insert Boy, and he's a founding member of the Dark Noise Collective. Brian and Dinez were in Chicago. I was in Brooklyn. We're going to hear excerpts from our conversation. The first thing that came up was the language in which we talk about violence. In particular, what gets labeled as terrorism. Dinez Smith got the ball rolling.
Terrorism is always attached to these brown bodies, to these religions that we see as something outside of this sort of cookie-cutter version of what we think about as American. But yet, sort of the terrorism that is experienced by everyday Americans is done by people who look a little bit closer to the founding fathers than they do these foreigners, these refugees often that we're scared of. You look at a headline, and let's say the shooter is white, and we're going to first go to find the gentlest picture of him. We're going to describe him as gentle. We're going to describe him as misunderstood and all these other type of things where as people of color, we are not allowed to be crazy or to be murderous singularly within ourselves, right? Our violence, our rage is always somehow representative of these communities in which we come from. A white guy is allowed to be crazy and murderous and that all those things and gentle and all these things by himself singularly, individual case. Is if I went outside and shot three people right now, everybody would be trying to figure out how my blackness relates to my decision to shoot. People would talk about my father's religion and how that was possibly some tie to what I went and did today. And so I'm interested in sort of just how the language of control and sort of the language in which our government, our media and all that uses to control our own fear. Because I think it's a little bit bigger than the actions that actually take place.
Brian, do you see it that way? Do you see the language of terrorism, the label of terrorism being put upon brown and black people and white people get an exemption from it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's consistent, too. You can look at, I think, Dylann Roof, you know, what he did.
Dylann Roof was the very young man who shot a bunch of people in a church in South Carolina.
Right. I mean, I think you have people on Twitter maybe calling him a terrorist, but then you have people in the traditional news outlets who are referring to him as like the lone wolf, which I think is kind of the typical descriptor you get when it's kind of the misguided white kid who's certainly not representative of a kind of culture of white supremacy where you've got the Confederate flag waving in the state that he's, you know, committing his murders. I mean, so I think it's either a laziness in the way that you're using language or it's a very conscious decision. But I think even when it's laziness, I think it reveals sort of the biases that are underneath it. So it's an inability or an unwillingness to think of white people as being capable of terrorists, of thinking of sort of Christianity, if that's what we're saying, that Christians are incapable of terrorism where other religions are really prone to it.
You know, it occurs to me one of the most effective terrorist organizations in American history, and they're almost never called terrorists by anybody, was the Ku Klux Klan. And why they're not labeled a terrorist organization is a mystery to me. Dinez, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that goes back to just the idea of terrorism is that we have to, I think we have to put value in the people that are scared or that are being terrorized. So the Ku Klux Klan is never talked about as terrorism to me for a lot. I think the big reason is because the people they were meant to scare are not looked upon as full humans, are not viewed as full Americans, right? And you know, in today, we're recording this in Chicago, where I would say that a lot of the actions of what has been done by the Chicago police, by the mayor here, would be considered acts of terror as black people are living in terror because of those situations. But because of the bodies in which that fear exists, it's not viewed upon as terrorism.
So you guys are both poets, and one of the many purposes of poetry is to accurately use language and perhaps to expose language that's not being used accurately. Can you guys think of any poets that are kind of actively dealing with this in their work?
Yeah. Somaz Sharif is a god to me in poetry, and especially thinking about how poetry interacts with politics. So a lot of her poems deal with sort of the language that goes around Islamophobia, a lot of the language of how language is limited, of how it is used as a tool of terror. So this poem, I believe it's from a longer poem. From Reaching Guantanamo. I don't know if you know, but if you send a letter to a prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, of course they screen it first and they like remove or black out certain words. So that's what she's doing in this poem.
Okay.
From After Guantanamo. Dear Salim, love, are you well? Do they, you? I worry so much. Lately, my hair, even my skin. The doctors tell me it's I believe them. It shouldn't. Please don't worry. In the yard, and moths have gotten to your mother's. Remember? I have enclosed some. Made this bath just for you. Please eat well. Why did you? Me to remarry. I told. And he couldn't. It. I would never. Love, I'm singing that. You loved. Remember the line that went. I'm holding the. Just for you. Yours.
So that's the poetry of erasure, in a sense. But it's puzzling because the words that are being cut out are personal words of endearment, mm-hmm. It seems. It's hard to know why those words would be cut out.
And it's hard to sympathize with somebody if those words are cut out, right? So those, I think those words are what would make the person who's getting the letter feel more than just some prisoner in Guantanamo Bay and every stereotype that we might attach to that. But it's just like, you know, on the news, when we talk about how the media talks to us, there's that same kind of erasure, that careful removal of what makes us fully human and intimate in order to sort of keep the figures of like what we see on the news, to keep them just figures on the news, to keep them as ideas and not full people. And I think that poem does that tremendously and like showing sort of just like what is left behind. But you feel those tender words, you feel the actual love and humanity that is cut out of the poem as well. And so,
Brian, is there any poem that comes to mind for you coming out of this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, just as Dinez was talking a little bit about the importance of having a space for voices, and it made me think a little bit of Camille Rankin's poem, Forecast. Camille, her book is
Incorrect Merciful,
Incorrect Merciful Impulses. Yeah, it's fantastic, just out from Copper Canyon.
Let's hear it.
Forecast. I twist myself into a knot the day pulls taut. I am what I am told. Good red meat gone necrotic. A spot of black spread out to ruin a perfect evening. It's the way the weather wears me. A cold, blank day, my blood-burned fingers. A white noise swelling in me. It's nothing but night now. That's how all the days end. An hour glistens in its glass case, turns rancid in my memory. Another day, another dress, the day lays out before me. I grow older if I'm lucky, and I'm lucky. My sad heart in its excess, such petty injury. I am worn against the weather, limp and prone to empty. What came before this? I can't remember. I dress for all the lives I want behind me. I have come here to make seen the day I see. I fall from focus. The day goes sour. It asks me nothing. It asks nothing of me.
Hmm. On its surface, it's a very personal poem, but how do you connect it back to a larger political context?
I think there's a couple places that really stand out to me as being personal political. I grow older if I'm lucky, and I'm lucky that it feels that's not just someone necessarily, you know, thinking about themselves as growing older, as being, you know, oh, death could always knock on the door. I might get hit by a bus. I mean, this is someone who I think they're writing from the experience of living in a society that can be antagonistic towards them, where it's your path to growing older is not necessarily as easy as
upper middle class white person.
I mean,
yeah.
I think it reads differently.
It reads to me like it's a poem written by somebody who doesn't feel at all in control of her life.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? In every way imaginable, it seems like somebody who's at the mercy of the larger world.
Yeah, so I mean, and you see that too at the end with the great lines, I have come here to make seen the day I see. You know, but then that's immediately followed up with I fall from focus. So the speaker doesn't have a lack of agency. It's an attempt at it, but it becomes out of your control at a point. Mm-hmm. The day asks nothing of me. It's a really kind of crushing place to end.
Let's skip now to a later part of the conversation when Brian Russell got to talking about poetry and education and what kinds of poems to bring into the classroom.
I worked for a nonprofit that worked in the Chicago public schools, and I remember being in a classroom, and it was eighth graders on the west side, and they were reading Patricia Smith's poem, What It's Like to Be a Black Girl, an amazing poem. And partly I was just like a little shocked because there's kind of like a not very safe for school moment kind of towards the end of that poem.
When I teach that poem, I take out the sentence.
Yeah. So
I take it out for my seventh grade.
I came in on the conversation, so I didn't know if they had read it or not. But either way, I was like, it was really pretty amazing to walk into this conversation of students. It was the boys in the classroom kind of got to talk for a little bit about how they approached the poem, and then the girls would talk for a little bit about how they approached it. And it turned into this really complex and interesting and serious discussion of race and gender. You could really see the students finding where their commonalities were, finding kind of where they diverged, and really talking into those spaces.
I understand, like, I'm teaching seventh and eighth graders, and I know that two of them, maybe three, are going to be a poet at the end of all this, you know, that will continue to write into high school and maybe beyond. And so how am I when I'm always bringing in poems, I'm trying to think about how are they useful to these students beyond the poetry of it. You know, so like that Patricia Smith poem you're talking about, that's always my day one poem. Yeah. If it's my first time going into a classroom, I'm 90% of the time going to bring in that poem.
Can one of you guys read that poem?
Yep, I got it right here.
All right.
What It's Like to Be a Black Girl, for those of you who aren't, by Patricia Smith. First of all, it's being 9 years old and feeling like you're not finished, like your edges are wild, like there's something, everything wrong. It's dropping food coloring in your eyes to make them blue and suffering their burn in silence. It's popping a bleached white mop head over the kinks of your hair and primming in front of the mirrors that deny your reflection. It's finding a space between your legs, a disturbance in your chest, and not knowing what to do with the whistles. It's jumping double dutch until your legs pop. It's sweat and Vaseline and bullets. It's growing tall and wearing a lot of white. It's smelling blood in your breakfast. It's learning to say fuck with grace and learning to fuck without it. It's flame and fist and life according to Motown. It's finally have a man reach out for you, then caving in around his fingers. It's a poem that teaches you how to read it and teaches you how to empathize with the author. You know, I think that's where poetry, in this whole conversation that we're having, right, is sort of language is most useful when it teaches us the language of how to relate to each other. You know, I don't know if our conversation in the beginning of this talk would be the same if everybody was forced to read a poem about the people who they are so scared of, who they fear so much, who they think are deserving of, you know, an ending of death, of murder, of whatever it may be. But once you're unable to look at somebody and not see them as a human, it's really hard to enact violence against them. And so I think, you know, what Patricia's poem is saying is like, hey, I too am worthy of sympathy. And I understand that you might not be, but here's a little bit about why I might be worthy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing poetry can teach us, and this kind of ties back to what we were talking about in the beginning, is whether you're going to be a poet or not, you're going to use language in one way or another for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And I think it really teaches you to be thoughtful and intentional about the language that you're using, in an understanding that the people who are going to be receiving your language are coming from an infinite number of backgrounds and experiences and bring different things to that. I think we would be much worse off without it.
We would. Yeah. More people should read poetry.
We need poetry.
We do.
Yeah. We do. They keep telling us that we don't. The New York Times tells us that we don't need poetry.
It's like once a season, right?
Yeah.
Somebody writes the poetry is dead article. But it's super boring. You know, you can't tell me poetry is dead when, like, if you are in Chicago, you will go to Louder Than a Bomb and see so many, like, young people, like, so excited about poetry and using it to just communicate so many things about themselves and their city, and it's beautiful. And how could that ever be dead, right? It's just, I don't know. I hate those articles so much. Whoever's writing one out there, just stop right now. Just go read a book.
Dinesh Smith with Brian Russell. On our website, you can find out more about them and read some of their poems. Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox.